Welcome to Radio Gorgeous. On Radio Gorgeous today, we are discussing Mermaid Singing and Peel Me a Lotus by Charmian Clift, who spent some time with her husband and family on two Greek islands and wrote two brilliant and dazzling memoirs, which are now back in print, thanks to Muswell Press. They're re-released for the first time in 20 years with a wonderful introduction on each book by Polly Sampson, author, lyricist, fellow of the Royal Society of Literature, and whose most recent novel, A Theater for Dreamers, features Charmian Clift as one of the characters. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, Polly Sampson. You have written the introductions to both of these books that have been re-released and available the first time in 20 years. They were very popular. When did you first come across these books?
It was 7 years ago now. And 7 years ago, I had a bunch of children and I'd finished my previous novel and it was about to be half term. And we wanted to find somewhere to just go and unwind and be with the kids. And a friend said, go to Idra. You won't regret it. It's really quiet. There are no cars. Tiny little Greek island. The clearest water. No beaches, but you swim off the rocks. She said, I guarantee you will love it. So we rented a house and off we went. And in that house was the second of Charmian's memoirs, Peel Me a Lotus, which is about her family's life on the island in 1956. And I was just gripped by this woman. And I really, really wanted to know more. She's just the best company. And so that was, as I say, 7 years ago. Those half-term children are now adults, and I'm still in my head sort of conducting conversations with Charmian Clift, despite that I've written a novel in which she's a central character. She just has one of those voices that you, in a way, you just wish she could be your best friend. She was a proto-feminist. She's amazingly modern. I mean, when you read her, you don't normally, when you read things written in the 50s or earlier, you know, you have those terrible cringing moments of, you know, because times have moved on. But she's so ahead of her times that you just don't get that at all. You know, if you compare her, for example, to the Durrells, who were writing about Greece in the same time, they refer to the Greek islanders as, you know, natives. I mean, Charmian would never say that. They, you know, I mean, they even call the Greek dogs native dogs. I mean, Charmian just has this fantastic way of seeing everyone as a person and not categorizing anyone. And, you know, and she's sharp as a tack.
Yes, they have a way of, the Durrells feel sort of Victorian.
Yes, she's more like sexed up Durrells, really, I think.
Exactly. And they were, when you say she was proto-feminist, it is very intense because they left London in 1954. She and her husband, George Johnson, came from Australia and left London in 1954, which just seems, it just seems sort of unimaginable sometimes when you're in this moment. But there have always been pockets of, you know, people call it bohemianness, but of just genuine openness. But it seemed, even to her, it seemed wildly hopeful.
Yeah, I mean, they went, first of all, the first memoir is about their first year in Greece, which was on the island of Kalymnos, which was incredibly basic. I mean, this is, you know, this is pre-mass tourism. People didn't go and live on Greek islands in these days. And it was an amazingly brave thing to do. You know, they had two small children. Absolutely, you know, nobody spoke English. There were, you know, very few mod cons. You know, certainly, you know, wouldn't have been any way of washing clothes apart from, you know, in a bucket of water. That very few flushing lavatories, you know, no convenience foods or any of the things they would have been used to. But she had grown up herself in a part of Australia called Kiama. She'd grown up on a mile long beach and she'd had quite a sort of wild childhood. And I think part of what maybe attracted them to this very sort of basic way of living was that how happy she'd been as this child with the sand between her toes. So I think she was used to living this sort of rather sort of pared back life. And they had been incredibly sophisticated. I mean, you know, they were both journalists. In Australia, they'd won a big prize for a collaborative novel that they'd written. You know, they attended all the great functions and they were on the radio and they wrote plays and, you know, they were fully integrated in society. In London, their friends were Peter Finch and all sorts of, you know, Laurence Olivier, and, you know, they mixed in sort of all these sort of circles. But I think that, you know, at heart, she always wanted to get back to a more basic way of living. And so I think that she was ideally suited for it, really.
And I hear in that a more outdoor basis of living.
Yes.
That more of your life is lived with nature, at nature, at the behest of nature. But just a more outdoor life than life in London, especially this past year, as we can feel, has been a very interior experience. One of the things that you pointed out in the introduction to the book set on Kalymnos, Mermaid Singing, was exactly that comment on the roles of the sexes. And I thought she was so prescient in seeing, and I find it bizarre that it's not pointed out more often, that this stiff roles of the sexes is just as banishing to men as it is to women. She, you know, likens them, they have no place but the sea on that island. The women own the property, and so they are banished to sea, just as in modern life they're banished to pride and shame, you know, the sea of that. But also, gosh, so at the mercy of their reproductivity. I mean, it's just astonishing. And in that moment, the chapter, I'd love to talk a little bit about that, because you introduce it so nicely, but don't spoil it for us, because when I came to that chapter, she does, and the part, one of the parts that you highlight is that she can foresee a time where that collective surge all around them of the roles of the sexes will pull her and George into those roles.
She's quite prescient on that, I think, because, you know, George actually wasn't the baddie in this story. I mean, George, that's what's sort of interesting is that we like to somehow pigeonhole them into good Charmian or bad George or vice versa. And, you know, there have been biographies of both authors and, you know, one works as a corrective to the other. There's a lot of finger pointing, but actually they were mutually supportive to each other. They really admired each other. He admired her writing just as much as she admired his facility for work. You know, he could write thousands of words a day, whereas she was, you know, more of a poetic writer. And so in some ways their collaboration was a very good thing. But the thing that she understood was that it was the times they were living in, not the man she was living with. So she knew, just as, I mean, and unfortunately we're still in this situation, but much less so, but she knew that it would be easier for him to make money from writing than it would be for her to make money from writing. So she was sort of split really between wanting food on the table, you know, for the family, so having to support him utterly in his endeavors, and at the same time, you know, having this burning desire to write herself. But she had to sort of temper that down, because he was the person who was going to earn the money, because men just do get rewarded more handsomely than women. And it's unfortunately still true today that it is easier for a male writer to make a living from writing than it is for a female writer. And she was just incredibly realistic about that. And so, you know, this idea of the muse, it's a double thing. It's that she knew that by making the conditions right for him, that would, you know, provide for the family. So it's society more than the man. I really think that can't be said enough.
It did when I came to the second book, Peel Me a Lotus, that became more apparent. You know, she's heavily pregnant and wildly encumbered, you know, yes. in this pregnancy, especially at the end, and marooned on an island without a midwife. And, you know, and because they have, you know, they move there, they buy a place, they are really now, they've committed. And that is a big role that Heathra plays in their lives, that it's not the holiday destination. And it is always different when you live there than when it's temporary, when it's holidaying, when you're holidaying, as you said, you went there to unwind from the boiler man, the not working, this, that, or the other, school, work, all of those things, to just focus on family. And it doesn't matter where you're doing that. They can be the most idyllic place, but, you know, it still has to be done. And as you say, in terms of that family life and that balance, I mean, I'm sure in your life, you've had some of those same things too. All of the work of life has to be done. And none of it is women's work or man's work, but it has to be done. Yes. It's a matter of valuing it. And it seemed to me, as you say, they did a good job of valuing what the other person did.
Yes, they did, certainly initially. I mean, it's a great tragedy. I mean, I won't spoil these wonderful books by talking about what happened to them later. I mean, they stayed a decade in Greece, and they only lived for 5 years after that, because things went really very, very, very badly wrong. George Johnston had TB, and the medication he took had a devastating effect on him in many ways, including making him impotent. And Charmian, you know, was a sort of vivacious, very, very sort of sexy woman in her kind of mid to late 30s when they were on Idra. And Idra was an island where lots and lots of, you know, gorgeous young poets, including, you know, as we now, you know, as we know, Leonard Cohen, and, you know, beautiful people came to Idra to paint and write. It became a whole bohemian community that George and Charmian were kind of the king and queen of. And, you know, she was in a very, very difficult position, as was he. And eventually, in the mid-60s, they went back to Australia, and George became, you know, he was dying, but he became incredibly successful with her help and published two novels that won the equivalent of the Booker Prize there, the Miles Franklin Award, My Brother Jack and Clean Straw for Nothing. And Charmian, amazingly, when they got back to Australia, became the most read women's columnist and campaigner. And, you know, she campaigned for the return of democracy to Greece. She campaigned against the Vietnam War, and particularly the barrel lottery conscription of young men, and pro-abortion, pro-women's rights to contraception. I mean, she became a very, very powerful voice. But unfortunately, she also became incredibly depressed. And the second of George's Miles Franklin award-winning books was actually about their time in Greece. And he was harboring immense anger with her. And he, you know, sort of shames her in this book. I mean, he writes about her infidelity, and he seems to be pointing the finger and claiming that this is what has exacerbated his illness. And he is, at this point, you know, a public figure, and so is she. And after a day of drunken rowing, and on the eve of this novel coming out, she took an overdose of his sleeping pills, and, you know, tragic. And then he died a year later. So it has a terrible ending, this story. But what's great about Mermaid Singing and Peel Me a Lotus is it's all before that time. And so you see them very much as a sort of team and together, and it's before they'd started drinking and before the infidelity and before George became so ill. But you can't help but have that sort of shadow falling on them, because it makes it sort of even more poignant how beautiful this life was that they were making together, and how much they tried to make a go of things, you know. And they really did. They had poverty to deal with. You know, they had so many problems, and yet they did, for that decade, make this wonderful life for themselves. You know, it's a sort of the dream that so many of us have, isn't it, to go and live on a desert island in the sunshine and, you know, and just work and do the things that we like and be with our lovely sun-blessed children. You know, it and for a while they did make that work. And so it's these books, you know, do become even more precious in a way, knowing just what happened at the end.
Yes, it was a shimmering ideal. It was, you know, the dream of a generation.
Yes.
But and also you do see a little bit, as you mentioned, the drinking and that sort of constant party lifestyle throughout 6 months of the year. It really does, you know, there's no self-renewal. We're all coming out maybe of a time like that as well. And that a little bit of self-care is really necessary, you know, and the some of the same disciplines she showed where people were trying, when she was trying to sort of keep her baby in a regular sleeping pattern, you know, and every single mother came in and like, the baby's crying. Yeah. That a little bit more of that towards herself would probably have helped them. I was wondering if that was one of the reasons that drew you to Charmian as a character, is that collaboration with her husband, because that was so extraordinary and it was, I mean, so heartening.
Yes. I'm also married to someone who I collaborate with. I mean, not writing novels, but we write songs together, David Gilmour. And so that, you know, once I'd read Peel Me a Lotus, and actually the original edition of that has a photograph of Charmian that is so, it's such a fascinating portrait, actually. Just the photograph is enough, but then you read her and then by that point you're sort of smitten. But also then once I got back and I Googled her, I mean, and saw that she'd written all these collaborative novels with her husband, that of course drew me in, because I'm always interested in that dynamic. And, you know, that's why I think that history has sort of done this down, because I can recognize things in their relationship. And, you know, my husband is incredibly supportive of my work. I mean, as supportive of my work as I am of his. And they had the same thing. I think the difference is that they just had no money. I mean, they were really thrown into poverty. And, you know, George Johnston was having to write Potboilers because he had this great capacity for churning out words. And so he became a little resentful because, you know, Charmian, although she didn't get much time to do her own writing, when she did, it felt to him like the sort of writing he would rather be doing, which is the sort of writing that doesn't necessarily put food in the pot. And so, you know, he, I think, developed, you know, a lot of resentment of her. I mean, he resented her good health, really, by the end, you know, because he was confined to the house. He could barely breathe. And, you know, there was his beautiful, vivacious wife still going out and swimming from the rocks or walking to the tops of mountains, all these things that he could no longer do. And so I could relate very much to the good bits, really, where they are supporting each other, and, you know, and how one can make that work. And I actually did feel, you know, thank goodness that I haven't been trying to do this in abject poverty, because that is in the end what did for them, I think. You know, if they'd had an injection of cash earlier, if they'd found success sooner, you know, if those books of George Johnston's that became such huge sellers, if only they had come along sooner, then they would have been all right, I think. I think they would have, you know, he'd have got the medical care he needed, and things probably would have worked out all right for them.
And it is intense. The driver here was that poverty, but then led to health and emotional, mental health issues as well. And that's, you realize how fragile that we all are. And it is that unraveling thread that just, you know, it all tumbles down. You know, I've heard of this silly advert that starts, but it all started off so well, but it did. The dreams are, to me, it's because they are these shimmering jewels of observance of other people, of herself, because they are such personal memoirs as well. You can't, when you're writing travel pieces, you can't help but insert yourself. But these are also, they're just 360 degree view on the island and the experience of being on the island. To me, in that way, despite I don't think those islands existing in that way anymore, they are sort of time capsules in that way too, that the planes hadn't come. The boats came, but the planes hadn't yet come.
The great thing about these books being republished now is that I think we all need it. We, you know, and she is such an immersive writer, and she really will take you to, you know, a different time and a beautiful island, two beautiful islands. And, you know, everyone who reads them sort of says that, that they feel completely transported by her prose. I mean, she really has a very unusual ability to make you present in her life and to see this, these beautiful places through her eyes. And it's not all good. I mean, she doesn't avoid, you know, the uglier parts of life. I mean, terrible things happen, but she's just got such an amazing way of writing about it. I mean, I just can't recommend them more highly.
What do you think it is about her writing? Sorry, but I just sort of from a technical point of view.
I think it's just what is it? It's that she has an amazing ability. Her voice is very, very warm, very intimate. You just feel she's writing events as they're happening. So you feel like you're just there with her, walking through those lovely cobbled streets and having a conversation with her. They feel like a conversation. They don't feel like someone just telling you things. You know, she's a very visual writer. You know, she engages all the senses. You know, you're smelling the beautiful lemon blossom, and you know, and you can hear the lovely music that's playing in the taverna, or you know, she makes you incredibly present. And her thoughts are not just, you know, about the things that are going on around her. They are thoughts about existence. And they're such interesting thoughts. You know, she does talk about, you know, life and death and everything in between. She's just an incredibly warm companion.
Yes, she's as generous as she is judgmental.
Yeah.
And it feels very real.
And she's very funny. She's incredibly funny. I mean, in the second book, Peel Me a Lotus, where there is this community, you know, in the first one on Kalymnos, it's very much, you know, they are the only foreigners there. But once we get to Idra, you know, there's an influx of people, and she's very funny. She lampoons them. And, you know, we know that the community that were with her, we know who they are, because they were, although she gives some other names in the book, we know that Henry Trevenna is the Australian painter Sidney Nolan, and his wife Cynthia Reed is Ursula in the book. And she says terribly wicked things. You know, she says things like, you know, he would set her alight if he needed light to paint by. You know, she's just got this, you know, and she really does have a very, very sort of sweet way of lampooning other people. And she makes me laugh out loud, actually.
I would say, I just from the very beginning of Mermaid Singing, just the opening scenes when their sort of fixer on the island comes and brings them a house. And most people would see it as the way of being cheated by foreigners or some such. But she says that he wants these things to happen for us. And he could see that they might possibly arrive in the very near future. Yeah. And it would make us so happy if it did. So he just tells us it's gonna.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is the best armchair traveling you can do right now when we are not yet allowed to travel. I, like you, would heartily recommend them.
Yeah, good.
Polly Sampson, thank you so much for your time this morning. Again, what are you working on? What can we look forward to from you?
What am I working on? Well, I've just done an introduction to another book with Hydra Roots, which is a book by Margarita Liberaki, which is called Three Summers. She was writing about a decade before Charmian. She's a Greek, obviously, and Penguin. It's another wonderful classic of Greek country life, which Penguin are reissuing in June. And I'm writing a few more songs at the moment, so I'm working collaboratively. We actually did write a song that came straight out of this book, which was there's a scene, not Charmian's books, my novel, A Theatre for Dreamers. There's a scene in A Theatre for Dreamers where the 18-year-old narrator is with Charmian, and they're in the cemetery on Idra, and she says to her, "Charmian, do you believe in ghosts?" And Charmian says, "Yes, I have ghosts, not all of them dead." And when I wrote that line, it was like she'd said it into my ear, and it gave me sort of prickles up the back of my neck. And so I wrote it on a piece of paper, knowing that that would be a lyric about the idea of really how haunted we can be by people who are not present. They don't have to be dead, but just not present in our lives, particularly if there's been some sort of a rift. And Charmian had one of those in her life because she gave up her first baby for adoption when she was 18. I mean, she had absolutely no choice in the matter. And so that had been sort of, you know, had been there. That's one of the things in my novel, The Theatre for Dreamers, that is sort of the troubling thing for Charmian and the thing that she doesn't talk about. And so that song, we recorded in lockdown, and in fact my daughter did the vocals and played the harp on it. And so at the moment David is working on more music in that sort of vein, and I will write more lyrics, so that's next on the agenda.
Yeah. Absolutely thrilling.
Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. Oh, well, thank you so much, Polly. Good luck with everything. Can't wait to hear more.
Thank you.
Again, Mermaid Singing, Peel Me a Lotus by Charmian Clift, and A Theatre for Dreamers by Polly Sampson. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The heat of the sun stayed on through the night, made specters of strangers playing games with my sight. I passed through the station, a face in the crowd. The whistle was blowing, the barrier came down. There was my baby in another's embrace. I called out her name in shame and disgrace. Yes, I have ghosts, not all of them dead, making dust of my dreams, spinning round and around in my head. Train on the tracks, teeth of the zip, the slider moves down, we were joined at the hip. Stealing the groove, the widening gap, unfastening rails from a past with no map. Yes, I have ghosts, a fleeting sight. It's always the living that are haunting my nights. Thank you.